This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, it's time once again for another series of Farm Hop farm tours all across Northwest Indiana. They're sponsored by the Northwest Indiana Food Council, and we have with us the president of the Food Council, Ann Massey. Ann, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, for people that are not familiar with the Food Council, explain first what the Northwest Indiana Food Council is all about.
Sure. The Northwest Indiana Food Council, we're a nonprofit volunteer organization where our mission is to build a just, thriving, and sustainable food system for all in Northwest Indiana, and we cover all seven counties of our region.
Now, for folks that aren't familiar with the Farm Hop series of farm tours is all about, how did they get started now 3 years ago now to this year?
Yeah, it's been our third year. We started in, I guess that would be 2017, touring farms that aren't normally open to the public around Northwest Indiana, both urban and rural farms, small vegetable farms, larger corn and soy farms, even animal production. And it just gives everyone an opportunity to see how diverse our farm businesses are around the region and to really dig in to see where your food comes from.
I imagine there are a lot of people that take the tours and they are very, very surprised at what they see. You can't help but not be surprised when you think about a typical farm, you know, and how unique these farms oftentimes are. There's just different types of things that are grown on the farms or animals that are taken care of on the farms. It's all just very amazing. There are two series of Farm Hop tours. One's already happened. It's August 10th. First, tell us a little bit about what happened on August 10th and what kind of response you got from folks that made the tours then.
Oh, absolutely. We've had great feedback from the folks that went on the August 10th tour, which departed from Valparaiso and visited Howe Farms in Crown Point, Acorn Acres Farm in Couts, Indiana, Sunnyside Drive Flowers, which is a slow flower farm, and several large truck farms that grow tomatoes, onion sets, mint, and corn and soybeans in our region. And most of the folks were really surprised at how many of our farms are trying to address really relevant issues like climate change and biodiversity and growing interesting vegetable varieties and heritage breed animals.
Now, for folks that don't necessarily know what a truck farm is, will you explain what that is?
Sure. These large farms we grow a lot of food in our region for large companies like Red Gold or Vlaspik that send in trucks to harvest from a lot of these farms that have thousands and thousands of acres in the southeastern corner of our region.
Mm-hmm. What kind of responses have you gotten so far? We probably continue to get them in. People get back to you on Facebook or on email or with the like, however they reach you on social media to tell you how they enjoyed the particular tours that they were on. What kind of response are you getting from people that have made the August 10th tour?
We actually have quite a few that are signing up for the September 21st tour because they enjoyed the August 10th tour so much. Mm-hmm. And they want to continue to see more and more farms that call Northwest Indiana home. Many of them find, even though it seems like it would be a long day going from 9 to 4, many of them felt like the day went by quickly and that they, pretty much everyone tells us that they had no idea that businesses like this existed in our region. And that they're just amazed at how much goes into producing food.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana Food Council President Ann Massey about the 2019 Farm Hop series of tours of farms. There's been already one set of tours on August 10th, another one coming up on September 21st, and we know there's another that's going to come out of Valparaiso. Let's talk about the one that maybe is the one that is the least likely of an area to find farms of this type, and that's out of Gary. That's a very interesting tour, and we know there are some very interested and people who are looking into finding ways to grow food, to treat the environment properly, and have seems successfully to be able to do so in of all places, Gary, Indiana.
Yes. This tour I cannot speak highly enough of. I think it generally isn't as well attended as we'd like it to be, and I'm not quite sure why that is, because Gary is a thriving center of urban farming activity and innovation. Many of the gardens that are on the tour are resourceful in ways that rural farms don't necessarily have to be. You'll get to visit East Chicago Aquaponics, which is an aquaponics system in the historic greenhouses of Washington Park in East Chicago, mm-hmm. where the system is it's a closed system where plants are grown in floating beds on water where they're fertilized from fish waste, and then the clean water goes back into a container of fish, and it's a closed cycle that it's a really neat to behold, and they can grow year-round produce this way with minimal input. One of our partner farms that we do a lot of work with, Faith Farms in Gary, they have an orchard, they have chickens for eggs, they grow all of their produce organically, they even have solar panels on the church next to the farm. And one of our favorite stops is a Rose for Yanina garden, a woman whose front yard and backyard are fully planted with really incredible and unique varieties of plants that you do not find anywhere. She has to special order a lot of her seeds, and it's planted with a permaculture background, so she really highlights the natural resources that are available to her in her urban neighborhood.
Now, before we leave Gary, let's talk about where folks can catch up with the tour. It's going to depart from location in Gary as it makes its way around through the region. Where is it leaving on the 21st to be able to take this leg of the tour?
Sure. The Gary tour departs from Art House Social Kitchen in downtown Gary, just across the street from Railcat Stadium at 9 a.m.
Okay. Now, the other part of the tour on September 21st is going to be departing from Valparaiso. And tell us about that. That's a little bit different from the one tour that was held out of Valparaiso in August.
Yeah. This tour will be departing from the Valparaiso Farmers Market, downtown Valparaiso, at 9 a.m. as well. And you'll get to visit a farm that has 600 egg-laying chickens. It's just, it's an absolute riot to visit because there are chickens everywhere. And the family, I believe, has 8 or 9 children that help all around the farm. It's just, it's really a special place.
Mm-hmm.
Triple B Tilapia, they're a fish farm in DeMott, Indiana, and they have a really interesting setup and grow a unique variety of tilapia. So you can get locally raised, sustainably raised fish grown right in our region. Pioneering Pig Homestead and Fairstream Farm, the Pioneering Pig Homestead has everything from honey to grapes to roasting coffee. They do organic vegetables and heritage breed animals. And Fairstream Farm does biodiverse vegetables that are available at farmers markets throughout the area as well.
Now, you're going to need tickets to be able to take advantage of this second leg of the two series tour, Farm Hop for 2019, that leaves September 21st. And tell us how you get tickets and in turn, what that is going to give you in benefits.
Sure. Tickets are only $20. That gets you transportation on the bus, as well as a local food lunch. We do serve lunch on the tours. We offer snacks and water. We try to make it as comfortable as possible. And you can get your tickets at nwifoodcouncil.org. They're on our website, and you just need to reserve them before the tour leaves.
Well, what a great opportunity to see some locally grown food and in turn, the produce of some type and animals. We're talking chickens in this case, and fish. But also, too, a chance to see how some very clever urban farmers have been able to take advantage or even some of the disadvantages of their own neighborhoods, depending where you happen to go, and turn it into something that is really worth talking about. And Ann, thank you very much for joining us to give us another idea of what the Farm Hop Tours this year is all about.
Oh, thanks so much, Chris.
Ann Massey is president of the Northwest Indiana Farm Council. Again, the second leg of the two-leg Farm Hop 2019 series of tours will be taking place on September 21st. The 2019-2020 edition of the Valparaiso University International Film Festival is just about to begin on the Valparaiso University campus. It's a program, a series of international films introduced by faculty on the VU campus from the Department of World Languages and Cultures and the Department of English. And with us to talk about it, we have Professor Tim Tomasek. And thank you for being with us on the program today.
My pleasure.
Well, tell us about the series in general, how to get started, and some of the interesting films that have been up in past film festivals.
Well, it started back in 2005, and we sort of had a discussion as a department of looking to find ways to maybe boost our presence on campus. And so we thought, well, we all deal with other cultures, and so why not find a way to create a program that might have broad appeal across campus? And so we decided to go along the route of a film festival. And so beginning in 2005, we tried to organize it where we would have three films per semester, so three in the fall, three in the spring, representing the languages that we teach in the department. So we would almost always have a film from France, Germany, either Spain, Mexico, another Hispanic country, something from China, something from Japan, and then for the sixth film, we would sort of reach out to colleagues across campus who might have interest in other areas and other countries and have them showcase a film from that area. So we always had, I think, the five films representing the languages that we teach and then something from outside of that.
How do you find out about some of these films that are out there? Do you get to screen them? Do you get word or look at reviews from other sources like magazines and like?
It sort of depends. I think with each language group, they tend to sort of meet and just talk about if there are films that they've heard of, if there's anything that seems to be buzzing at that particular moment in time. Sometimes we'll look and see what, for example, what the foreign film and the Academy Awards, you know, what the nominations were, and maybe take a look at those. In the case of French, which is the language that I teach, there is sort of an ongoing film series sponsored by the French government on American campuses, and so they publish every year their list of the films that they're showing across the country. And so sometimes if I'm looking for a film, I might go to their website and just find out what are the films that seem to be really important or interesting that particular year, and I'll just sort of scan through them and decide and pick one that works. So I think we tend to pick films that are relatively recent, so something that may have come out in the previous 2 or 3 years. We try to pick films that are award-winning in some way, but sometimes we're also picking films that might have a particular relevance to a course that's being taught in a given semester, and so it gives us an opportunity to sort of allow the students in that course to have access to the film in a more public way, but also to share it with the rest of the campus.
Have you had an opportunity to be able to show films at a recent film festival that turned out to be Oscar winners?
The one that we actually have this year on this year's program, the German film that we have, which is called Never Look Away, it's from 2018. It was actually the winner of the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film.
Oh.
And there have been many like that in the past. I can't recall exact titles over the last 15 years of which ones, but I would say every year we probably have at least one, if not Academy Award nominee. We typically have ones that may have won other awards at other film festivals.
That's great. We should probably mention right now, too, that the one we just talked about, Never Look Away, is going to be coming up here. The screening is going to be on Friday, November 8th. So let's go down the list, besides the one we just mentioned, of all the films this time around.
So this year we've got coming up in September, September 20th, so this is already next week, we have our Japanese film, which is called Like Father, Like Son. And all of the films for this year are going to be screened on Fridays, beginning at 7 p.m. in the Neil Science Center, room 234. So this is sort of a big lecture hall that we have. It's a good space for film screenings.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got the Japanese film coming up next week, October 18th. We have a film that's sort of a joint venture with Spain and Argentina, a film called Truman. And then, as you mentioned, November 8th, we have our German film, Never Look Away. And so that's the series for the fall semester. And then in the spring, coming up on January 24th, we have a French film called The Workshop. And in February 21st, we have a film from China called Duckweed. And then our sort of outside-the-department film for this year is actually coming from Egypt. It's a film called Yomedine, I mm-hmm. think, and that's on March 27th.
Wow. Do you get some response from folks that have either heard about these films ahead of the actual screening or watched the film and they have something good to say or bad to say about it?
We for the screenings, we take maybe 5 or 10 minutes at the beginning, and whichever professor is sort of taking the lead on that film will give a little bit of context, a little bit of explanation of where the film's coming from, if there are some particular cultural elements that might be important for an audience to understand before going into the film, they might explain that. And then typically we try to come back to some kind of a discussion at the end of the screening just to see what was the reaction from the crowd, what did they like, what did they not like, see if there are questions that they have. Sometimes some professors will give the audience some leading questions before the screening and then come back to them afterwards. So there's often a good half-hour discussion afterwards where people have a chance to really sort of give their feedback about the film, but also talk about some of the issues that may come out of the film.
That's great. Now, is there someplace people can check out certainly the list of films that are going to be offered in the fall and in the spring semesters and make note so they can be sure to put that on the calendar to see a film?
We have a web page on our department website, and that's valpo.edu/worldlanguagesandcultures/film, and you can see the entire docket of films for the year. And then I think there is probably a press release on the university website, and there may be other places on the university website where this shows up or where there are at least links to it.
That's right. Well, thank you for spending time talking about not only the International Film Festival series that has been going on for years, but also the ones that are up for screening this time around. And we hope that people take advantage of the opportunity to see some interesting foreign films, as they were often called, but certainly international in nature now. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Professor Tim Tomasik, who is with Valparaiso University, talking about this year's, the 2019-2020 Valparaiso University International Film Festival. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here is your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Mr. Scott Weber. He's the Transportation Planner and Analyst for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, NERPC. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Carl, for having me back on.
So, Scott, remind our listeners, what is NERPC and what do you do?
So, NERPC stands for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. We are a regional council of governments as well as a metropolitan planning organization serving northwestern Indiana of the counties of Lake, Porter, and LaPorte. We participate with our 41 municipalities in 3 counties, and we help them solve problems in transportation, the environment, and the economy and quality of life in our region. So we are a forum to bring together the leaders and voices of our region and help produce productive solutions for solving these problems and these issues that we all face.
So I hear you're working on updating the congestion management process for our region. Can you explain what that process is and what really it is?
Okay, so thank you, Carl. The congestion management process is just as it sounds. It is a process to manage traffic congestion in our region. There are federal requirements that we have to meet for the congestion management process, but above all, we want a congestion management process that really meets the users' needs, that is, the needs of you all that use the transportation system on a daily basis. So at the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, we have a congestion management process in place already that we adopted back in 2011. But now that we have a 2050 plan for our region, and in light of the many technological advances that have come along in transportation since then, we think it is a good idea to update our congestion management process.
So how much of the problem has traffic congestion been to our area?
Well, first of all, I want to start with the premise of what is a problem? Well, a problem is defined by the users who experience it.
Okay.
So if our users think traffic congestion is a problem in our region, well, then it probably is. But if our users do not think that traffic congestion is a problem in our region, then by definition, there is no problem. As a transportation planner, my job is to bring the facts to the forefront and to let users and stakeholders decide what is the problem, if any, there is. And then from there, we can help identify solutions that there might be to those perceived problems. Because any solutions that come out of the congestion management process will only be effective at addressing the problems that we can all agree that might be problems in the first place. So as far as what the facts say, I can say that in the entire Chicago urbanized area, the average person is exposed to just under 15 hours a year of excessive delay, that is, sitting in traffic at either under 60% of the posted speed limit or 20 miles per hour, whichever is faster, during the peak hours of the day. That means that the average person sits about 15 hours of his or her time in traffic. Now, this number would be significantly higher for commuters because this is averaging in commuters that are exposed to this traffic every day, sure, multiple times a day, as well as those who hardly ever drive. So the average total is 15 hours, but obviously commuters experience more than 15 hours a year sitting in traffic. Now, I can say that compared to other urban areas around the country, this is in the Chicago region, other areas of the country experience significantly more than 15 hours. I can't give you those numbers off the top of my head, but I know that they are well into the 20s and in some cases maybe even approaching 30.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So we're not doing too badly as far as what the facts say. But that said, if our users see traffic congestion as a problem and possible solutions to that problem, then we're happy to accommodate those solutions in the congestion management process update.
You're listening to the Green Fleet Radio on Lakeshore 89.1 with our guest, Mr. Scott Weber. He's a transportation planner and analyst for NERPC. So, Scott, what else will be involved in updating the congestion mitigation process?
So we're putting together a working group for updating the congestion management process. This working group will deal not only with the congestion management process, but also with freight movement, and specifically designating critical urban freight corridors and critical rural freight corridors in our region. The group is actually still forming and has not met yet, but we have sent invitations to stakeholders who we think will have the most to contribute to a productive dialogue in managing traffic congestion. But we'll also be involving all interested members of the public through public engagement techniques that we'll use throughout the process, such as we'll send out a survey at some point to ask users about their experiences mm-hmm. with traffic congestion in our region. And the working group, I can say, will include NDOT, who's the primary owner and operator of the region's major roads and highways. That's the Indiana Department of Transportation, as well as the Indiana Toll Road, the Klein Avenue Bridge, and hopefully at least a transit operator or two, as well as some of the municipalities. Like I said, we work with 41 municipalities in our region.
So what tools and resources are you using to help you update this process?
So we primarily, in this day and age, are able to use passive data collection. That is, that the data that's being collected is already happening out there. We don't mm-hmm. really need to actively go out and measure it because people, just by driving in their cars, are pinging the cell phone network, for example, and we're able to pull anonymously data from the cell phone network through a tool that's called the NPM RDS, or the National Performance Measure Research Dataset, that we get for free. So we're able to get a ton of data just from people already driving around in our region without us having to go out and collect additional data. Mm-hmm. That said, we do also collect additional data. We send out some of our in-house staff to drive some of the roads during certain times of day just to kind of validate the data that we're getting, as well as reach a little bit further than that data set covers. But we're getting a ton of data on travel times that will be able to inform us throughout this process. And so we're using those tools and techniques to help us update the process.
So when do you expect this update to be completed?
We expect that this update will be completed. We'll have a first draft by March of 2020. Then we'll open that up to a 30-day public comment period. And so probably by late April and early May, we'll have the final draft. And that final draft will be adopted by the NERPC full commission in May 2020.
There's a lot of information. So how would our listeners learn more about what NERPC is doing on this process and other programs that NERPC has in progress?
So, Carl, thank you. Of course, I would always encourage listeners to go to our website at www.nerpc.org. That's NIRPC.org. You'll find several ways to get involved from that website and get plugged into our latest updates right from our homepage. There's a section on the right sidebar titled Stay Connected, where you'll find links to all of our social media pages, including Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And you'll also see an area in the center of the homepage titled Sign Up for Information. You can put in some of your contact information as well as checkboxes of your interests, and we'll be happy to sign you up for our email listservs. So thank you.
Well, Scott, you do a great job, as well as your teammates at NERPC. We're just really proud of all the great work that NERPC does for our region, and we look forward to hearing more about the plans and other programs that are coming up in the future. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Mr. Scott Weber, transportation planner and analyst for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Support for Green Fleet Radio comes from South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission. You can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. Today marks 18 years since the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. That means that most high school students weren't alive when the attacks happened. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingart spoke to the social studies teachers at Clay High School in South Bend about how teaching the topic seems to have changed.
For those who lived through 9/11, it's a day that will never be forgotten. Darcy King Oblenis teaches U.S. history and government at Clay.
It is a hinge of history. And you do remember where you were, what you were doing, how you felt, and how you were forced to process. And so it is innocence lost, and it's stunning, and it was an emotional impact.
And early on after 9/11, students had those feelings and memories as well. For today's high schoolers, they don't remember 9/11, but they live every day with the impact of it. They've never been through an airport without people taking off their shoes. They don't remember a time when America wasn't at war. They don't have the same expectation of privacy that older generations do. And some of them don't know what happened on September 11, 2001 at all. Janae Hartman is a social studies teacher at Clay.
Since I have the freshmen, my job is to introduce the topic. These kids were not born. So they, unless they've been introduced to it early on, they don't know the details of 9/11.
Hartman starts out with what the United States was like before that bright Tuesday morning.
We had fallen into this complacent comfort zone of no one attacks the United States, and how when something like that happens, how we have to shift our societal norms and go forward with those kinds of changes.
Then the students learn what happened that day and what has happened since, the societal changes that impact everyday life in America 18 years later. King Oblenis builds on that. She says she tries to get the kids to connect with the event. She has them interview an adult that remembers 9/11. Then the students have to write about an experience in their life that impacted them.
The confusion, the astonishment, the fear, the anger, and try to capture that in their own personal life. When in their life did they experience something that changed maybe the trajectory of their life?
Wendy Harmon teaches social studies at Clay High School. She says in her classes she tries to use 9/11 as a teaching moment for what it means to be American.
Trying to connect them with those feelings of what do we want as a nation? What do we want as a country? Who are we as Americans? So I kind of take some of the small snippets of things and then kind of relate it to current events and how it might relate to them now.
The teachers' goals are to use history to help the kids understand the impact the past has on the present and on the future. King Oblenis.
My history kids can hopefully connect emotionally. My government kids, an emotional connection, but maybe a real life connection of issues that are facing us today.
One day, it will fall on this generation of students to pass on the history and lessons of September 11th to those even further removed from the events of that bright autumn day 18 years ago. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
Here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, we've learned that the Indiana Landmarks has a new online guide that is going to showcase the home styles over 200 years. In fact, if you get the Indiana Preservation magazine from Indiana Landmarks, you get a chance to check out a few of them here, but we'll find out more in particular. Let's talk to Suzanne Stannis. She is the Indiana Landmarks Director of Heritage Education and Information, and thanks for being with us on the show today.
Thank you, Chris.
Tell us first how this online guide got started.
Well, we decided that we wanted to do something that was very visual because we had had an old-style guide that was printed that just had line drawings that was done well before probably even the invention of the Internet. And we decided with this, you know, newfangled technology, we could put a lot of photographs of Indiana examples. And then eventually our goal is to be able to have people submit their own photos, likely through Instagram, and we can continue to build that database.
How do you think it was? Went back maybe back in the 1950s or so, or maybe even earlier, when that printed guide was first issued?
Oh no, it wasn't really that early, but okay. No, it was. I think we started it in the 1980s, and then kind of had various incarnations of it. But the problem was, it only showed line drawings, and in cases it only showed one example. And the thing with architectural design is that there are so many variations on each style that it's really hard to show one drawing and say, this is what they should all look like.
I guess this also probably didn't take into place what might be considered, at least back then, even back in the 80s, some of the home styles that went back even before then. Like back during World War II, when you talk about the Lustrun homes and the homes that Sears Roebuck used to have their plans on in the catalog.
Yeah, we really added a lot of styles, including those, you know, as you said, post-World War II. And the other thing that we've done that we feel is different than a lot of existing online and printed style guides is we've tried to include vernacular styles. And those are defined as houses that are, you know, typically built by builders or taken out of pattern books or represent particular regional styles. And they're really what most of us live in. And you'll find that the majority of style guides feature what we call high styles. And those are the things that are architect designed and, you know, quite elaborate. So we try to put a lot more information into those vernacular styles. And for example, when we did that first printed guide, we listed a lot of things as just carpenter builder. As just, you know, that's what these simple styles were. And we've since been able to go back and work with folklorists and come up with specific names for each of those styles based upon the shape of the building. So you get the T plan and the L plan and gable front and that sort of thing. The other improvement that has been made since we did the old printed guide is so much more research has been done on the mid-20th century styles.
Mm-hmm.
For so long, we just, again, lumped all those into contemporary, like we did with Carpenter Builder. And there's been a lot of scholarly research on, again, trying to break those down into subcategories and give those more accurate names.
I understand that you all did a lot on so much research on this that you were able to put into the online guide a way for anybody that goes onto Indiana Landmarks website and looks this up to find out really a bit of history, a lot of history, actually, maybe I should say. You can learn a lot about how we lived in Indiana by the home designs and how a home was built back then. What were some of the things that you all noted, we'll say, from Victorian style homes to today?
Yeah, and I think that's what really makes the study of architecture more interesting. You know, we're not just looking at details and what makes something Italianate, but we're looking at why was the style popular when it was. And so that's the sort of thing that we have included with this online guide. And say, for example, looking at, you know, the Victorian era, the Queen Anne houses were really highly decorated on the inside. They would have wall-to-wall carpets. People would often have like animal skins on the floors. They might have all sorts of, you know, just little knickknacks sitting around. And then as people started to understand the germ theory towards the end of the 19th century, they realized that germs are what make people sick. And so we see the craftsman style becoming very popular in the early 20th century, the late 19th century. And people are getting rid of a lot of that heavy interior decoration. And they're even making some built-in furniture. If people have a house from that period, they may have built-in bookcases or a built-in sideboard in the dining room and hardwood floors. And then even sleeping porches, which I find fascinating. You know,
mm-hmm.
They thought that, okay, getting outside, getting fresh air was going to make you healthier. So people would actually sleep outside on these sleeping porches, often even in the cold weather.
Did that kind of lend to the development eventually of screened-in porches?
That's a good question that I honestly don't know the answer to. I'm sure that it must have at some point because, yeah, those early sleeping porches often would have wooden louvers, and so they weren't necessarily screened. But, yeah, good question. And that's something we could add to that website. And the beauty of the website is you can change it, that we should look into the history of technology of metal screens.
Also, too, when you were putting together the online guide, did you have an opportunity to, again, as part of history, to compare what some of the architects had looked at, maybe as they grew up, as they were being trained? They may have looked at maybe the Bauhaus designs, especially some of these homes that were the architects of fashion furniture that goes along specifically with the type of home.
Yeah, exactly. And you definitely start to see that with the mid-century modern styles. And Frank Lloyd Wright is a perfect example of that. In the houses that he designed for clients, He often designed the furniture. He went so far as to, in a couple of cases, design clothing that he thought the woman of the house should wear. So I don't know that anybody else has gone quite as far as Frank Lloyd Wright, but mm-hmm. we do see architects that are designing furniture that will fit in that style of house. So it may not be that they designed it for a specific house, but this is what they recommend, you know, in that type of house.
Are you finding that having the online guide available by folks that go onto the Indiana Landmarks website goes along very well to people that manage to take the tours? For example, like folks that check out the Century of Progress homes up here in Northwest Indiana, when the homes are up for display to the public, once a year, you have a chance to take a look at these homes, and it kind of goes back to the Logs to Lestrens tour that's been held. You get a chance to make the comparison with types of homes back in the early 20th century, going all the way up through now.
Right, exactly. I mean, you can go back and look at our website and see why were log houses built when they were and how were they changed. And the Logs to Lestrens tour is a perfect example because we have a log house on that tour that actually had been covered in siding mm-hmm. and removed. And so the style guide talks about, you know, why were things covered in siding and as well as the history behind the Lestrens. So, you know, you'll likely get that information on the tour, but if you forget or you want to share it with anybody, you can easily go back to our website and check out those sections.
Now, I know we've just kind of mentioned it briefly here about how you can find this online guide. Specifically, how can you find this new online guide to home styles over the last 200 years?
Well, right now, if you just go to our website, IndianaLandmarks.org, you'll find it right on our landing page. We're featuring it right now. After that, we have a tab that's called Resources, where we've got all sorts of information helpful for people that are researching their houses or do-it-yourselfers, and it will be combined into that section. And I might also add, mm-hmm. if somebody's interested in researching their house, because we do get a lot of questions about that, we already have an online historic research guide that's also in that resources section. So people can go there and get tips on how to research their house.
That's great to know. Thank you for mentioning that, to be sure. And thank you, Suzanne, for joining us on the program today to talk about this very interesting online guide that's now available out there on the Indiana Landmarks website.
Well, thanks so much. We hope people will visit the website as well as participate in one of Indiana Landmarks programs.
Suzanne Stannis is the Indiana Landmarks Director of Heritage Education and Information. As the opioid epidemic continues, hospitals are looking for new ways to treat pain and to combat addiction. At Indiana University Health, that means change. They're cutting back on opioid prescriptions and giving more advice to patients. Lita Noon filed this piece with Side Effects Public Media.
IU Health has a big presence across the state, 16 hospitals. And in January of 2017, officials began monitoring when, where, and by whom every opioid was prescribed. Chief Medical Officer Jonathan Gottlieb says the results were eye-opening for his fellow doctors.
I think no one really knows when they're operating independently. Am I in the middle of a bell curve? Am I at one end or another? And so just showing the data caused a dramatic reduction in the number of pills prescribed.
Comparing the first month of monitoring to one of the most recent, this April, nearly 440,000 fewer opioid pills were prescribed. And that's important because many people feed an addiction by getting pills from friends and relatives. IU surgeon Amy Krambeck cut back opioid prescriptions for other reasons. She specializes in removing kidney stones.
We use a small scope and go up into the ureter, break up a stone, and pull out the pieces. And it can be a fairly painful procedure.
She says opioids are the standard pain medication after the procedure. But she found while lecturing in Mexico, that's not true everywhere.
I came back after one of those trips and said, I just want to stop giving narcotics to our patients and start using anti-inflammatories, smooth muscle relaxants, other ways to manage the cause of the pain.
Krambeck says her team worried post-op patients would call for more medication, but that didn't happen. And in the first year, it kept 4,600 opioid tablets from going home with patients, possibly ending up in the wrong hands. Gottlieb says another success is the 30% drop in opioid prescriptions at IU Health emergency departments. The biggest drop, 90%, came in Frankfurt. Phone alerts indicate a patient is waiting for one of IU Health's peer recovery coaches. The new program helps people who are addicted to opioids and come to an emergency department for more pills. They'll meet someone like Spencer Medcalf and get an unusual welcome.
My name's Spencer. I'm a peer recovery coach, but more importantly, I'm a person in long-term recovery from a heroin addiction. What brought you to the ED today? What's going on with you?
He's one of seven coaches working at a 24/7 hub in Indianapolis. Through video chats, they help patients get treatment across the state. Medcalf's own experience helps. He got clean when his family cut him off.
So when I hear patients in the ED talk about those things where, you know, my family is concerned or my wife or husband's really concerned and they're talking about getting a divorce or leaving, that's kind of an internal red flag.
Cutting back on opioids in post-op and emergency departments is a start. Gottlieb says it's more challenging when it comes to patients with chronic pain.
One of the things that we and others are doing is offering alternatives that are not only to reduce the risk from opioids, but actually to offer more effective pain therapy.
His dream is to have IU Health provide wraparound care with specialists in fields like rehab, neurology, and psychiatry. Pain researcher Dr. Kurt Kroenke of the Regenstrief Institute in Indianapolis says doctors still feel a lot of pressure, especially treating chronic pain.
Most physicians are feeling they're being heavily watched, whether it's by the DEA or state regulations or their healthcare systems, that you're a good citizen, the less opiates you prescribe. And if you prescribe beyond that, you're being scrutinized.
He says it's a tightrope for providers. Control chronic pain, don't underprescribe causing harm, and don't play a role in new addictions. Meanwhile, Krambeck is trying to convince reluctant colleagues to reduce opioid prescriptions.
Just getting it out there and getting it on the table for them to hear, I think sparks the wheels turning. And I could tell that they were considering how that would affect their practice, and that's the first step, is to just start thinking about it.
The change isn't over for IU Health. Hospital leaders say it will take a couple more decades to address all the areas of the opioid crisis. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Lee DeNoon.
Indiana University Northwest, which is, of course, based in Gary, is offering up a new bachelor's degree curriculum program in neuroscience. Well, what's neuroscience and why is it important? That's why we have a chance to talk with Assistant Professor of Psychology Maureen Rutherford about it. And thank you for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's ask the dumb question number one. What is neuroscience all about and why is it so important, especially if you want to study it in college? Because there are so many applications out there in the real world that people should take advantage of.
Absolutely, and thank you for asking. So neuroscience in general is the study of the nervous system. It's really critical that we study the nervous system because it's really the center of everything. It controls our thinking, it controls our behaviors, it controls physiology. And so there are many applications of this. There are hundreds of disorders that involve the nervous system. Mm-hmm. And so understanding how the nervous system is working to control behavior and physiology helps us to understand how we can, you know, treat disorders and what does that mean for people and functioning.
We're talking basically, in this case here, being a college curriculum series, it's going to be able to help teach students of all ages, I assume, more about, opportunities that will apply in healthcare fields, in other science fields as well, too, I understand.
One of my favorite things about neuroscience is that it is so interdisciplinary, and so we're drawing on a lot of really awesome resources at IU Northwest. We have a really strong psychology program, and also the other life sciences, biology and chemistry that we're going to be drawing from. And that's going to help students prepare for a broad variety of career pathways because they're getting so many different perspectives on anything involving the nervous system.
So I guess, too, that there's opportunities to train people, and not only if they want to go on and become nurses or even become doctors, they have a chance to get some experience and learn some things that will be able to pay off in careers like in lab tech work.
Absolutely. And so part of the curriculum is their senior capstone is to do research in the neuroscience lab. And what the students will do is they design a project and they collect the data and analyze it. And so, you know, a lot of students come in thinking that, oh, well, you know, this is really only going to apply if I do research. And that's not really true because This is also going to involve like information literacy and using using data, which you know a lot of career pathways will use, figuring out how to present numbers in a certain way and interpreting those. Also being able to explain how they got to, like, what was the purpose of doing this project, and also how to, what does that mean for somebody who may not be trained in science? Like, that's really one of the goals of really me as a teacher, being able to have people spread that information and do it in a way that makes sense and that is correct.
Now, since this curriculum series is going to be offered in the Department of Psychology, you have to have partners, obviously, in other parts of the Indiana University Northwest campus to be able to help make these courses really relevant to students. Tell us about these other partners that the department's working with.
The other departments that we're partnering with would be mainly biology and chemistry. We also are drawing part of the curriculum from computer science. Like I said, you know, using software packages and programs is essential for the students to know how to use. You know, we have some really great expertise in those other departments that students will have a chance to learn from. Like I said, the curriculum itself is very interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. So they'll get hands-on lab work in not only the neuroscience lab, but also in those bio and chem labs as well.
We're talking with the Assistant Professor of Psychology, Maureen Rutherford, at Indiana University Northwest about the offering for the first time, I understand, at least here in the region, of a bachelor's degree in neuroscience. How distinctive is it to have a first in this respect?
I'm actually really excited about that because I was actually born and raised in the region. I attended IU Northwest. And I was always kind of interested in the inner workings of the brain as well. And so that wasn't really an option for me when I was attending school in the region. I was able to go get my graduate work right outside do my graduate work in Chicago, mm-hmm. and then come back and be able to bring, you know, some of my expertise now back to the region to help help students learn more about this really, really exciting area that, like, many, many places offer this, but, you know, was still somewhat lacking in the region.
Now, if anybody is interested, whether they're a current IU Northwest student or somebody who's interested in taking classes at IU Northwest, how do they go about getting themselves lined up to be able to get into the curriculum to be able to get this bachelor's degree in neuroscience?
Absolutely. So if you're already a current student, just come and talk to either myself or somebody else in the department. If you're an interested student, just check out the website, apply, or talk to somebody admissions. Also, I'm always willing to talk to students that are really interested or prospective students that are interested in the curriculum. So website, email, call, get in touch.
What type of opportunities will students have, besides, of course, taking the courses at IU Northwest, to maybe be able to do some internship work in some other fields that are related, to be able to work towards the degree?
We do offer an internship course here in the psychology department. There's also opportunities for possibly doing lab work. I have a student right now that's working with one of my colleagues over in Illinois, doing a little bit of work in her lab. And so there are opportunities for the students to get kind of more hands-on work, either through internships or these work opportunities, as well as doing, you know, independent research in the labs on campus is also an opportunity as well.
Do you also think, too, that over time, since this is brand new, that there will be some opportunities to get some internship opportunities here in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, that would be awesome. So if anybody out there has some sort of link to neuroscience, I'd be more than happy to chat with them about getting students in and getting students some opportunities for those experiences. Mm-hmm.
Is there any information that's up on the IU Northwest website right now or will be in the weeks and months ahead to let more people know about the fact that this new BS series is coming up in neuroscience?
Yes, absolutely. There's descriptions on the IU Northwest Psychology Department page. There are links to the degree descriptions for both the BS and the BA. We have both a BS and BA option for neuroscience. And so if students are interested, they can check that out there. And my contact information is there as well as contact information for the department.
Well, Professor Rutherford, thank you very much for your help today. And we'll get the word out. And hopefully people will check out the IU Northwest website if they are interested in pursuing a bachelor's degree in neuroscience. And we appreciate you talking about it today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Maureen Rutherford is an assistant professor in psychology. The Department of Psychology at the IU Northwest campus in Gary is the first now, making IU Northwest the first in the region to be able to offer a degree program in neuroscience. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow it's Thursday, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we'll have Hannah Reed with the Post Tribune and Joseph Pete with the Times to tell us about the stories that they have had in print and posted online, and also a conversation with David Wright from Gary Public Transportation Corporation. We hope you can join us.